Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Welcome to another episode of Acts of the Blood God, an independent RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, Kat. You get Dragon Quest Builders, too. And you get Dragon Quest Builders, too. And everyone gets Dragon Quest Builders, too. And finally, I am spreading my gospel across the world.
Nadia's taking the wheel. God knows where we're going to go. Probably into a pit somewhere.
Forget Jesus. I'm in charge now.
Joining us is Eric Van Allen.
I think this is beautiful because this was a major point of contention we had all the way back at US Gamer when we were making that list of, I think it was best of the generation or
yes.
Yeah.
Top 100 list or something. I don't know.
And we had a giant fight over Dragon Quest Builders being on the list or not. And I distinctly remember lines being drawn in the sand and arguments being had. And finally, we're going to resolve this in the great pantheon of November 2023.
Be there or be square, Enix.
But before we get to that, it's Halloween, at least tomorrow as the release of the podcast, and we're going to be talking about spooky RPGs like Omori and Parasite Eve and Undertale and such and such. We'll get to that in just a moment, but first, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a review on the podcatcher of your choice. You can follow me on Twitter at @_Catbot, Nadia's @NadiaOxford, and Eric is @CMoosey. And we're on Patreon at patreon.com/bloodgodpod, where, as we were just alluding, we have just picked a new pantheon. We are going to be covering Dragon Quest Builders 2 as part of a theme of RPGs that we are grateful for. And apparently we're grateful for DQ Builders 2. I have promised to Nadia in the name of our friendship that I will put it on my Steam Deck and I will play it for at least a little bit to see how I like it.
Yeah, I think everybody should. I will say, give you a PSA. It works fine on Switch, but it's not like the best version because I think it does have like a frame rate cut and it does have frame rate dips. But it's a very cozy game. So if you can get it on your Steam Deck, that's the perfect place for it. I don't know if it's optimized, but it doesn't exactly run on a lot of hardware there.
We've also already recorded our Castlevania Symphony of the Night Pantheon, and we had a big guest list, including Shivam Bhatt and Anthony Agnello, and returning pal John Learned, who did the Castlevania Symphony of the Night annotations on YouTube. And we had a great conversation, very in-depth. Frequently, everybody just kind of took over the podcast, and I was just a bystander. But we all had a blast. It's like 2 hours long, and I think we did great justice to Alucard. I think, what was that term that we came up with Alucard by the end? I can't even remember.
Like, listen to the podcast. Knows. He's the Bo Jackson of vampires or something like
right.
that.
Alucard knows. The Bo Jackson of vampires. You'll have to listen to the podcast to understand what the heck I'm talking about. One thing that we're going to start doing, just to tease for next year, we're going to start releasing old Pantheon episodes like 2021, 2022, free, or not free, sorry, at a la carte to listeners. So if you make a subscription, or if you make an account over on Patreon, you don't have to pay or anything. You can download individual episodes of Pantheon for a nominal fee. We haven't set that nominal fee yet, but the idea is that new Pantheons remain exclusive to the Patreon folks. But we have a huge library at this point of great Pantheon episodes, and we just want to make it so that y'all can listen to some of them, even if you're not necessarily subscribing. So that's one thing that we're kind of looking into for 2024. Okay. Let's talk about spooky RPGs. Spook.
Ooh.
The best RPGs to play on Halloween. Incredibly, we've never done this topic before. And it feels like
I find
omission.
That hard to believe, but yeah, I guess that's the case.
I went through our archives and the closest we got was spookiest RPG creepypastas from 2021.
Oh, Godzilla, man. But that's not RPG, I guess.
I'm not much of a Halloween person. I don't like to dress up because I'm boring.
You should. You know what? I didn't like to cosplay very much. And then one day I just said, you know what? Screw it. We're all going to die someday. And I started cosplaying. And you can see behind me, if you're watching us on the video, that I have my first cosplay that I did of a mask of San from Princess Mononoke. So that went pretty well. That was a good cosplay. Why are you holding up a Pikmin, Eric? What does that mean?
Because I got my costume in yesterday, literally. I have an astronaut outfit and a little Pikmin, and I'm going to be Olimar for Halloween. I'm very excited about it.
Oh, where are you going? You're going to like parade around downtown. It's going to be freezing and raining here. So,
yeah, it depends on what the weather's like here in Texas, but I'd probably just go to a pretty decent, chill place. I'm not hitting up Sixth Street or anything for those of you who've been in Austin, but find a cool place to hang out and just kind of get some beers, hang with some friends, and enjoy the Halloween season and everyone good. Dressing up and having a good time. Yes, I am going to go trick-or-treating door to door.
That's wholesome.
Don't worry, I'll say.
But
no.
Also wholesome.
Hello.
Happy Halloween.
This might be post-show, but I was having the moment today where I was like, when do you set out the candy for the trick-or-treaters? Because do they go on Halloween or do they go on the weekend before Halloween?
In my neighborhood, it was always the day of.
It was always the day of? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I thought. Okay. Good. We'll convene more about Halloween talk at the post-show, but...
Yes. We have a very... Yeah, no, okay. Yeah, so let's talk Halloween in the post-show, but let's talk about spooky RPGs right now. Plenty of spooky RPGs out there. As we've alluded to many times, I think we thought that we had done a Halloween episode at some point on this show because more than once we've tried to put together a horror RPG pantheon and we've really struggled to be able to find good picks for it. So I think it's because we've had that conversation. That said, there's still plenty of great spooky RPG options. And the one that springs to mind immediately, it's getting a sequel. It's in our top 25 RPGs of all time. It's one of Eric's favorite RPGs. And that's Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, which for my money has one of the spookiest quests in RPG history, which is the Ocean House Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
What is it with hotels? Hotels are just freaking scary.
I mean,
I love that.
It's creepy.
You've been in spooky hotels, right?
Oh God, yeah. Like I love those hotels where it's totally like the Overlook. Like they haven't changed the wallpaper since the 70s, and the carpet is all shiny because everyone's been walking over it for centuries. And yeah, I love that kind of vibe.
Oh my God, like Nadia, when I was in Japan last year, I stayed in the spookiest fucking hotel.
Nice.
It was exactly what you said. It was this Overlook Hotel vibe. They hadn't changed the wallpapers since the 80s. The lights were off in the hallway most of the time.
I love it.
So I was walking to...
just Japanese Shining Twins. That'd be crazy. They'd be like schoolgirls or something.
And they had ads for weddings, like have your wedding getaway in this spooky hotel. And even the wedding ads managed to be terrifying. The bride had this kind of fixed smile, like, I'm having my wedding here.
Had till death do us part in it, but parentheses aggressive.
You had to read it backwards in the mirror to see the death do us part.
And I was trying to save money on budget, so I got a really cheap room, which turned out to be in the smoking wing.
Oh, gross. Ew.
And so the room had this 80s look to it. It was stank of stale cigarette smoke. Early pit here, but yeah, big creep vibes here.
I'm just picturing you coming into the room and there's like a ghost hanging on the bed and it's like flipping through like the ancient CRT TV and going click, click, click. And just like says,
chain smoking and flipping through
smoking.
The channels.
But if they had had a Famicom in there, it would have been right with the world. But, the Ocean House Hotel, very iconic quest for a certain group of people. Eric, tell us about it.
Yeah, so the Ocean House Hotel is kind of interesting because Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines is already a very supernatural game by design, right? It's set in the vampire world, and you're playing as a thin blood vampire who has been turned when you weren't supposed to be turned, and now you're in the middle of these court politics and get sent off to this task, and you quickly figure out that you're probably on this task because they don't really care what happens to you because this hotel's messed up. It's got some stuff going on in it. There's all these kinds of jump scares and things rattling around. I actually did an escape room while I was in New York recently where it was a Silent Hill themed escape room. And they had a lot of similar jump scares where things would just kind of like fall behind you. And it would, I leapt out of my skin a few times. But it's like that. But also I find it interesting because a lot of times when games do ghosts, especially when they're games that have combat like Vampire, you will eventually start shooting the ghost and looking at you, BioShock Infinite.
Take that ghost.
Shoot the ghost.
And I think that like takes away the horror, the terror, the spookiness, because now it's just another thing in the game that you have shot at. But what's really cool about Vampire Bloodlines is that you broadly do not do combat in this area from my recollection. And it's mostly just an exploration area that you are solving this ancient curse, this haunting that is taking place. And it's a really cool, interesting sequence because of that. And granted, like a lot of games do that sort of thing where they pivot to a non-combat segment, non-combat focused segment where you do some solving, some puzzle solving, some environmental storytelling. But I think it works really, really well for Vampire Bloodlines because, yes, vampires are creepy and spooky. And there's a lot of parts of Vampire Bloodlines that feel very moody and evocative, a lot of like darkened alleys where the game is kind of signposting you to lure civilians in so you can get some of that sweet, sweet blood. But it's very moody in that way. But I think the horror sets in when you realize that there are other things in this world that are also supernatural and that are well beyond your comprehension or ability to deal with. And you just have to like get through it. And I think that's a really compelling moment because of that. I think of Pathologic 2 the same way, where Pathologic 2 is not an outright scary game, but the general like vibes of it, the mood of it is very oppressive, very scary. When you see the giant construct in Pathologic that should not be able to exist, like literally should not be able to exist, it is that moment where you're like, there are things happening here that are beyond my comprehension that I have to cope with now. And that's what I like. That's a good mood setter.
That's my favorite kind of horror. I don't like gore.
Yeah, same.
Gore is just gross. I do like horror beyond our comprehension, cosmic horror. That is the deadlights of it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I really like Japanese horror. Like, I think the original Ringu is better than The Ring, even though The Ring is great, don't get me wrong, but there's something about the simplicity of Ringu that makes it so much more creepy to me. Like the way the video is so incomprehensible that to this day when I watch something weird on the internet, I'm like, oh shit, I'm gonna die in 7 days, because that's the kind of mood it just gives off. Like, what am I looking at? What am I hearing? What is this man with a towel on his head? Like, that's the funniest thing. Like, the West can spend like millions of dollars on the most beautiful, gory, horrible effects you can think of. And then in Japan, some dude puts a towel in his head and starts pointing. I'm like, oh shit, I'm not sleeping tonight. So yeah, I just like, sometimes simple is best with horror. Like, just to kind of use a cliche, breaking it down to the human level.
And I agree with Kat. I think a lot of like the cosmic horror, the like world that is beyond our comprehension that expands out into the infinite nothing is really compelling, because that's something that we have. I mean, it's a legitimate fear that I have in real life, is like, what is the universe? That is creepy to me.
The universe is coming to get you. It's at your door. Knock, knock.
Yeah.
The universe has a big, big mouth.
So if I may put a video game forward now that's actually pretty recent, because the 1.0 release just came out, World of Horror is a really good Halloween time game, let me tell y'all. That game has been in early access for years and years and years at this point. And it's basically like, what if a PC 98 engine got haunted?
And, that would be creepy, actually.
Get Audie in here.
It's really compelling, though. Like, it wears all of its influences on its sleeve. It's got Junji Ito in there. It's got a bunch of the, like, classic horror in there. It's very one bit, very monochrome. It's got that PC engine. I was joking with someone recently. I was watching friend of the show Michael Hyam play it. And he was saying there's so much stuff. And I was like, yeah, but that's the cool thing about the interface is it's got like everything you need there. You never have to go digging through menus or pulling up other screens. Everything is right there. So you are constantly facing the scares. You are constantly looking at this like bloated teacher that has risen from the drowned pool and is like attacking you. And you are like always face to face with it. And I think that's really cool and really interesting. And it's got a lot of great cosmic horror. It's got a lot of great ritual type stuff where you're having to try and figure out the way in which you can try to exorcise these ghosts or defeat them in some way that is very... Because in horror movies, you know, the second you turn it into, oh, I stabbed the ghost. that's kind of my point. Is the second you are dealing with a ghost in a conventional way, then it's not scary because the scares are supposed to be unconventional, incomprehensible. And so having to deal with them in very roundabout ways or figure out the way to deal with them is a really cool part. I think World of Horror grabs that very well.
I think one of the reasons we don't talk so much about like, oh, let's list horror games, because I think games are much better at putting horror into games where you don't expect it. I want to give a shout out to Tears of the Kingdom. I know I have before on this regard, but I think one of the scariest manga, one of the scariest things actually ever written is The Drifting Classroom. It's just terrifying. And I find that the underworld in Tears of the Kingdom is somewhat inspired by that. If not that, then Uzumaki. Like, the thing that really is scary about The Drifting Classroom is not just the fact that it goes total Lord of the Flies in 5 seconds, but the fact that they are in this world that is completely desolate. Like, there's an iconic shot where the main character is looking out over a 2-page spread of this horrible alien looking sand, and there's nothing there. Like, everything's gone. His mother, his father, like his life is gone. And the adults are all going crazy. And those kind of like swirls and spirals make they're very, very prominent in a lot of Japanese horror. And even before Junji Ito, like Junji Ito was inspired by The Drifting Classroom. And I think it's actually hilarious that he said one of his first things to do as a young manga artist was to make a sequel to The Drifting Classroom, and it turned into a comedy somehow. So that's exactly the kind of thing that would happen. So I go into the underworld in Tears of the Kingdom, and we still don't know a whole lot about it. And what you find is what you just kind of glean things from what is there and how they relate to the surface and the sky. But in the meantime, you're stuck in this dark world where, again, going back to like how Asia really nails horror, the sound design in that area is absolutely just, you know, heart racing. And that is something, again, that Ringu, I think, does a lot better than The Ring, is has like these random high pitched sounds or low tones to kind of creep you out. And that's what Tears of the Kingdom does as well. Yeah, I just think that that place, it set me on edge for a good few months. Like, you fight for every inch that you map in that darkness. And if it's not a monster coming after you, it's like poison, gas, whatever, malice. It's just a really well done bit of horror. And Zelda does great horror. Like, we talk about Majora's Mask all the time, even parts of Twilight Princess. Yeah, Nintendo, they can go hard when they want to.
It's funny. I'm not a horror fan, but I am a horror appreciator, quote unquote, in the sense that I have big respect for what it takes to pull off really good horror. And I think some of the best auteurs out there kind of got their start in that particular genre, because I think you have to understand psychology and mood and sight and sound to do really high quality horror. And so much horror just sort of feels like a schlock, right? But at the same time, I don't particularly like being was super uncomfortable all the time. And usually when I'm watching a thing, I want to be compelled or just be able to relax, and horror feels like I'm on the edge of my seat all the time, or squicked out, whatever. But
yeah, I get that.
Good horror can be funny, like darkly funny. There's a really solid sense of humor to high quality horror. So I have big respect for the folks who can really carry it off. I find a lot of horror just kind of bad, actually, but especially the gory stuff. Like, don't at me with Hostel and whatnot. But
I have no plans to watch Saw or Hostel.
No. But
like Hellraiser for some reason. I don't know what's wrong with me.
I like Hellraiser because I think it ties into the almost cosmic horror aspect of it.
Yeah, you're right. And it does kind of delve into the real darkness of mankind's mind. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Stuff that I really enjoy, Alien, because that's like psychological horror as well.
Exactly.
You don't really know much about the xenomorphs even now. I mean, I don't really count the more recent Alien films in there. But Hellraiser, one of the creepiest, there's some like really creepy scenes in Hellraiser 2, I want to say. Like the lady who has the skin turned inside out.
Yeah.
Or when they go into the maze and the guy gets turned into a Cenobite.
Yeah.
I was just like, ah. Like, but the maze with the creepy vision, and that's great visuals right there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So it's not just gore for gore's sake. I mean, even like when I was a kid, like they say now, oh, kids today, blah, blah, blah. But no, when I was a kid, like there was such a stink over like Nightmare on Elm Street and Freddy and all that crap, and like Jason. And nothing's really new under the sun.
You might know, have figured this out by the name of my cat, but I really like old, like Edgar Allan Poe style horror. Very much like poetic horror, I guess you would say, is where someone gets their comeuppance. There's some hubris involved. There is kind of this feeling of the terror being part of a, like being a storytelling mechanic. And I like it when the horror drives story and story drives horror.
Wasn't,
and they can kind of play hand in hand.
Was it Poe who wrote The Pit and the Pendulum? Because that's a terrifying story. Because that's all psychological.
You know, I've got a great cask of Amontillado if you want to come on down and check it out behind this half brick
wall. For God's sake, Eric.
I apologize because I'm going to sound really basic here. I do think that Stephen King is really damn good at coming up with high quality horror.
Me too. I'll simp for him till the end of the world. And games borrow so much from Stephen King, they have no right to talk.
Salem's Lot was a very scary vampire story, if you've ever read it.
I've read it.
Decimation of a small town by a vampire moving in, and how more and more it's just really down to like two people, basically.
Yeah.
And the moment when they go into the actual vampire house and what happens in there. Just the concept of Salem's Lot is endlessly creepy to me, because again, that plays into that sense of the unknown.
Yeah.
It works really, really well. Stuff like people going, dying and then returning from the dead, but not coming quite back quite right.
Pet Sematary is the only zombie I find terrifying. I think they describe it more as a Dybbuk, which is actually a Jewish spirit a malicious spirit that inhabits like people, but they kind of mix up their mythology. But either way, the zombie who, when Gage starts talking as an adult and he's still like a baby, that is terrifying. I'm sorry. Sometimes dead is better. If you're going to give a shout out to Stephen King, though, you have to say that, I have to say, one of the first instances that I can remember of cosmic horror in a video game, let alone an RPG, was Earthbound. That was the fight against Gigas, is literally against the Deadlights. And what's really terrifying about that fight that a lot of us in the West had no idea, like Gigas was a character in the first Earthbound. He was an orphan baby alien taken care of by Ness's great-grandparents, I think it was. They got rescued, or they got sent back to Earth, and Gigas was left alone. And he went insane from loneliness and turned into that horrible universe devouring thing that's not evil, just an amalgamation of terrible feelings, and is ready to break out and cause havoc because Porky is a shit disturber. And all it really takes is one shit disturber to make a real horror.
You know, I was thinking about games that we need to play on the Twitch stream the other day. I had not considered Earthbound, and now I'm considering Earthbound, because that all sounds metal.
Oh, Earthbound's fantastic, but it does have a bit of a hump to get over in the first part. It can be archaic at points, but if you know how to play it, it's pretty easy.
Tired, Earthbound, Wired, Mother 3.
Mother 3 didn't really have the cosmic horror, though. Or did, no, it, Mother 3 had a really, really sad ending, but I don't think it had the cosmic horror.
I'm not saying from a horror standpoint. I'm saying if we're talking about streaming games, maybe Mother 3 is a good
game. Oh, maybe Mother 3 might be,
Yeah.
Talking about RPGs and the way that horror fits into them, I think one of the best examples of a horror game, or maybe it's overrated now because we all remember it being better than it actually was Eternal Darkness. And Eternal Darkness worked really well because it used the mechanics in the game and basically a series of tricks to convince you that it was almost like the horror, like you were going crazy right alongside the game.
Yeah.
Right? And so my first thought is RPGs, by definition, often let you engage with the mechanics in a lot of ways that other games don't. A lot of games are kind of a walled garden, sort of like an iPhone, whereas RPGs are like a PC. You're meant to tinker with
Hi,
them.
Hi, I'm the iPhone. I'm PC.
Yeah.
Remember those?
I think you could do really compelling stuff with stats in horror games. I think Darkest Dungeon's a pretty good example of when your characters are going crazy, their insanity meter is going up. Having a sanity stat... that's a good ass stat in RPGs, yeah. I think.
Drew in the chat is asking any favorite times when non-horror RPGs get spooky, and it immediately made me think of Baldur's Gate 3. I'm trying to stay like mostly spoiler free, but near in the last act, there is a certain scene that can happen with characters where they will act very strange and very different from what you are used to expecting. And the first time it happens, even the first several times it happens, it caught me off guard. There is basically a character that is hunting you and will constantly get the jump on you in Act 3. And it's really fun. It's really, really good the first time they pull that off. And you're just like, ah.
Yeah.
You start suspecting every NPC that you talk to after that because you're like, are you normal? Are you normal? Are you going to do something? Are you going to scare me? Okay, good. All right. Let's chat. Where's the... Oh, God.
There is an instance, actually, in Breath of Fire 2. This is kind of spoilery, but no one's going to finish that game anymore unless they hate themselves. This is a game where you're worshiping Saint Eva, and Eva is like the god. He's great. He cures the blind, all blah, 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 blah. And he is kind of presented as a benevolent figure. But, of course, the bad translation kind of screws everything up. But you do kind of see as time goes on, okay, well, this is a problem. And it really kind of accumulates when you fake your way into the big holy city that he has created on this island. And you're going in, like, kind of infiltrating it. And you talk to people there and they're like, I love St. Eva. He cured me of my problems. I love St. Eva. Everything's so beautiful here. Everything's so perfect. When you try to leave, you're put right back where you started. And you can't get out. And you hear this, like, terrifying chime. And when you talk to people, now they're telling you, like, I want to die. I'm so cold. Where am I? What is going on? And when they talk to you, you see the dragon's tear drool, which kind of like reflects what people feel about you. And if the dragon tear reflects like a rainbow color, it means the people like you. The people here, every time they talk to you, the dragon's tear is just black, which means they despise you. They want to kill you. So... despite the fact that this game had a terrible translation, it was only a 16-bit RPG, that was a very scary moment for myself. I kind of have a nightmare like that where I'm trying to leave a house, I'm being chased, and I'm trying to leave the house, and when I leave the house, I find myself right back where I was. So maybe it's just a personal thing, but yeah, that was a moment for myself.
For me, leaving the house is also true horror. It's just the scariest
thing. I feel like that sometimes.
Did you ever see the Robin Williams film, What Dreams May Come?
No, I haven't seen that.
Is that what it's called?
I don't think I've seen it. No.
Maybe I'm wrong. In it, his wife commits suicide and is very sad. And I think his kids die too. So it's dark start to the story. He goes into the afterlife trying to find his wife, basically, and learns that she is in hell, actually.
Cool.
And its vision of hell is really good. It's not fire. It's dark and lonely, and you're just stuck in your own head all the time, basically. Oh. And
shell.
Yeah. It's a visually very lush movie. Its depictions of heaven are really, really colorful, really interesting. One of the things I like about it is in heaven, you can take on kind of any form that you want. So he doesn't even really recognize his kids right away. Spoilers for like a 25-year-old movie. He doesn't even really recognize his kids right away because they're in different forms than he would expect. And then that contrasts heavily with its depiction of hell. And talking about things that I find compelling in horrors, whenever characters end up going to the underworld, I suppose, because the journey through the underworld is a really strong literary trope, so to speak.
Yeah, the story of Orpheus. That's who went to Hades, right, and screwed up.
I mean, that idea of being stuck in your own head is very relevant to something like Omori, where that whole game is about regret and like the past and things that are kind of haunting you from them, and you're kind of jumping around these different perspectives. It's been a while, so I can't like fully. I say it's been a while. That's a recent release, but it's a really. I remember that game being extremely compelling because of the way it could so quickly shift its tone, and it would make the more creepy aspects feel almost normal, and the overly happy, overly cheery parts feel like slightly sinister, if that makes sense. Like you have this kind of home base where you are in this Yume Nikki inspired room, right? And mm-hmm. and that initially is very offsetting, but it becomes very comfortable. And then the second you are in this world where everyone's just so happy and having so much fun, and we're going to find them with the power of friendship, starts to feel like vaguely sinister in a way. Like you're waiting for the pin to drop because you've seen what this game is saying is like the baseline, and it's not hitting that baseline. You're just waiting for the shoe to drop. And when it does, it's really compelling. I feel like Undertale does the same thing, where early on they have that encounter with Flowey, and they show, oh, this is not like a nice, happy, fun world. Mm-hmm. This is a bad world, or it could be a bad world. And so you spend the whole game wondering, when is that other shoe going to drop? When am I going to suddenly understand like why this is full of monsters in here and not just people?
That's the thing I liked about Omori, was that it wasn't just a game about anxiety and depression and agoraphobia. And its depiction of agoraphobia is brilliant. Like the first time the monster chases you down the stairs that won't end.
Yes.
That scared the shit out of me. And it was such a good visualization of what, you know, I've had a bit of agoraphobia myself, and that's like a good visualization of what it feels like. And the portraits are so well done. But what really drove me with Omori was there was a very specific mystery behind everything. It wasn't just like, I'm a sad boy who has sad feelings. It was like, why do I have sad feelings? It's like, okay, I'm Omori. I am a kid with anxiety and I have depression, but I have friends. You know, I have a loving family. What went wrong? And the answer is darkness
of nostalgia. Nostalgia, we often hold up nostalgia as kind of this like nice thing or thing to be pursued. And this game is about nostalgia, but it's evil nostalgia.
Omori, you know, it's what would you say, Eric? I wouldn't say it's really about nostalgia. Would you like?
Well,
I mean, one of the key things is that photo book. Well, they're looking back on
that, yeah, like as a story thing, yeah. But yeah, okay, so where are you coming from?
I think both of you are on the money because yes, I agree, nostalgia is part of it, but it's a painful nostalgia because it's that idea of there were golden times. There was a time when things were good, and number one, you might have done something to destroy that, to change that. And number two, now you don't know how to get back to that. And if that's not compelling, I don't know what is, because that is that sort of like deep heartache that can really resonate. Oh, especially as you get older, as you kind of look back on your years and you go like, oh, what if I had done things differently?
Yeah.
Was it something I said back then that caused this rift to form between me and another person? And that's that tension. That's that anxiety that Omori captures and does very well, and then turns into its monsters, turns into its gameplay. And I really, really like that.
Same.
Moonblaze Wolf, by the way, said, I'm just waiting for a discussion of Shadow Hearts.
That is regrettably a game that I feel
like
a
spot for me.
Kadelka and Shadow Hearts are games that I know I would probably really like. Same with Baroque. I think people were talking in Discord chat today about Baroque because there was a top RPGs of all times list that came out recently that had Baroque on it. And it recently got like a fan patch or something. And those all seem like games that I would probably really enjoy. But Kadelka and Shadow Hearts are really cool because they have that atmosphere, right? Like they go for a genuine survival horror atmosphere that you don't see matched up with RPGs very often. And for whatever reason, because I do think there's a lot of overlap there, but there is something really compelling about the idea of horror in a format that we're not used to that I think really people latched onto.
Can I just take a moment to be sad about Darkest Dungeon 2?
What was wrong?
Absolutely.
Was it wrong or was it bad? I don't know.
It's fine. Graphically, it's nicely improved. They just really changed it a lot. So the original was you're going into dungeons, the darkest dungeon with
the
a party, and coming up with a composition to tackle each of the different environmental types was really compelling. And of course, you spend a lot of time and effort building them up, and it's quite nerve-wracking because it's in perma hardcore mode. And so if they die, which can happen because things can suddenly go very wrong, and all of a sudden your characters are going crazy and they're slashing themselves against these cosmic horrors that have just shown up out of nowhere, and what the heck is going on? And it's a lot of effort. I think it's a little hard to recommend in some ways because as good as it is for the first like 20 hours, it gets quite grindy, like ridiculously grindy and very repetitive.
Yeah.
But there's still a really compelling core that is very memorable to me. And Darkest Dungeon 2 greatly changes that. Darkest Dungeon 2 is a roguelite where you're in a wagon and you're heading toward this insanity mountain and periodically stopping at rest stops, and that's your campfire kind of area. And it's just, you don't feel the same attachment to your individual characters, and the run doesn't feel quite as important. It has fewer classes this time around. And it just doesn't hit in the same way, which is too bad because at its heart, Darkest Dungeon is one of my favorite ideas of an RPG ever.
Right. I understand that.
I think a big thing with Darkest Dungeon and why it loses some of that atmosphere is what you were talking about, is that it's more focused on the run into and less focused on the management side, the fact that in Darkest Dungeon 1, you were having to make decisions about sending this person who had so much history with you, who had so much, you know, they had been this clutch character that won a dungeon run for you, but was like afflicted with all these complex thoughts and had great victories, but also had like these really like these vices that they held in their heart that you had to let them indulge, and you had to like get them safe and get them ready, and you're like, okay,
get them into that brothel
and then push them right back into that dark dungeon because you got to go back in the dungeon, buddy. And then to watch them fall is its own compelling storytelling and even its own compelling horror storytelling. You can start filling in the blanks with your mind, and from what I've seen and played of Darkest Dungeon 2, it just doesn't do that, because I think you can tell a compelling story in a roguelite, but you have to build it to do it that way. And
I
don't
Hades
know if Darkest Dungeon 2 is built as as narratively compellingly as Darkest Dungeon 1. I think the run stuff makes it a more interesting roguelite, but I don't think it makes it a more interesting Darkest Dungeon. And that is like the key problem.
Still first rate art though.
Oh, and absolutely.
Monster designs, fantastic. The sense of world being ruined, decay. Adventurers who are all horribly flawed in their own way, fallen knights and schemers and plague doctors. It's great in its own way. It captured my attention almost the moment that I saw it, because I love great art in RPGs. But Darkest Dungeon 2, maybe there's something more compelling that I'm missing. They have been pretty good about supporting the games and improving them greatly over time. The original Darkest Dungeon got tons of support over the course of years, but I suppose we'll see. Before we move on, anybody want to like recommend an RPG if like somebody's behind between RPGs to pick up during the spooky season?
I have two. Ooh. One's really quick because I already talked about it. World of Horror is fantastic. Y'all should all support it. It's a wonderful game. I think it's, if you look at an image of it and say, this looks like my shit, it is your shit. Congratulations. But number two, I know we've talked a lot about like gory, scary, creepy, gnarly M-rated stuff on here, but shout outs to Costume Quest, which is a very Halloween game that you can play with the youngins. And if you are looking for that, if you're looking for something festive that you can play with children or whatever, Costume Quest is a really fun, really straightforward, easy to understand game that they will absolutely love. And it's a good old time. It's a double fine game. How can you not love it?
Also, the main artist designed Boo in Monsters, Inc. and various other Pixar things. So that's kind of fun.
She's a fan of the show, too.
Yeah.
So, I think
she's gone from Twitter, but if you're still there, hi, I hope you still listen.
Yeah, she lives on my island.
Oh, tell her I said hi.
Somehow we've never met, though.
Why did that sound like Animal Crossing?
Yeah, she lives on my island.
Did she put her house on top of your house, Kat, and say hi? We're neighbors now.
The game I'm going to recommend is Bloodborne, one of the scariest and most excellent action RPGs I've ever played. We were talking about how we really enjoy cosmic horror, and there's a moment in that game where you're walking and all of a sudden this terrifying light shines on your character and your sanity meter starts going crazy and it's making this terrible sound. And I think horror is so much about audio design, and absolutely. Bloodborne has first rate effing audio design in it. And so I think I said that when I was playing this game, go check out our Pantheon of the Blood God episode about Bloodborne. I felt like I was going crazy myself because this game puts in every single, it's like, are you scared of it? It's probably in Bloodborne. It is a mood. It's very scary. It's one of the best horror games I've ever played. How about you, Nadia?
I'm going to kind of jump off your back and recommend Elden Ring because it has a general atmosphere of creepiness. And of course, FromSoft, it's pure FromSoft, you know, kind of like put the dots together about what's happening with the story, but there's a lot of like weird things like melted tree faces that are big hints about what happened and what went on. But what really makes it scary for me, like actually like, oh God, get me out of here scary, was I'm just going to say, fuck FromSoft basilisks. They're terrible.
They're awful.
Yeah, yeah. Who made those? Go to jail right away. Just the tiny, tiny pinprick eyes, but the ones that are, it's such a great adaptation for a basilisk to have. It's so beautiful as someone who loves nature writing and nature things. But dear God, why? Who had a nightmare? Someone had a terrible nightmare. We all have to suffer for it.
I think that From Software does a really great job of visuals and letting you use your imagination to fill in the blanks. And that's, again, something that works really well in horror. When you over-explain a thing, it stops being scary. But when you're imagining it, of course, your imagination adds to it by a factor of 10 times. And it's funny because, Eric, did you just post an Evangelion picture in the chat?
Yeah, I did.
I think Evangelion's a fantastic example of horror, actually, in the sense of, End of Evangelion, where the world is literally ending, spoiler alert, is a very horrific sequence. It feels beyond our understanding and such. And I like that they do explain how things work, but it never really feels like you have a clear grasp of it. Everything, mm-hmm. humans feel tiny in this universe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And end of Evangelion, you know, everyone just is reminded of the soft drink Tang. And it's it's great cultural relevance.
Me too, the orange drink.
But even original Evangelion, I posted an image of the, I think it was the 15th angel that sang the hallelujah chorus at you and then made you suffer from all your mental illnesses at the same time, which, yeah. Oh, that one still hits for me.
Yeah, I just think it's fun. I feel for the people, the poor people who are just coming to work. They're like doing their daily commute and they show up and they're like, oh, it's still good. It's still good. It's just we have unlocked the vault of Galth or whatever it's called. It's
the seventh
still good.
Seal.
It's still good.
The doors of Guff are open. The ritual has been complete. Was the Dead Sea Scrolls have been honored?
Oh, he's rising into the sky. He's got the energy wings. This doesn't seem great.
The boys are in the sky.
There's a giant ray encompassing the world.
The boys are getting silly in the sky, making giant Judeo-Christian motifs.
All right. What do you think is a great horror RPG? Is there one that you missed? Share it in the chat. We want to hear about it. All right. It's time now for a series of random encounters. The Fallout TV show is releasing in April 2024. We're looking forward to that one. Lords of the Fallen has reached 1 million sold. Xbox has done a big reorg with Sarah Bond, now a president, Matt Booty in charge of Bethesda. Elder Scrolls 6, by the way, was apparently revealed early due to quote-unquote pitchforks and torches. Diablo 4's latest expansion, the first one, is expected to be called Lords of Hatred. And finally, Like a Dragon 8 has a whole ass Animal Crossing island, and I, for one, am really looking forward to it. Now we're heading. Sorry, go ahead, Nadia.
Oh, just the idea of a whole ass island. Like, I'm obsessed with my island, FF14. So it's like, oh, okay. So I wonder if it's the same kind or if it's more Animal Crossing style.
I just want to say that I love seeing Ichiban on a dolphin.
Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You can't go wrong with dolphin riding. I know we talked last week about how they're assholes. And they are, but I still want to ride a dolphin. I still
like
fun.
Dolphins.
I love dolphins.
Dolphins are great. I will hear no dolphin slander in this one, but I am looking forward to Like a Dragon 8, even though I wasn't able to finish Like a Dragon 7, a game that I also enjoyed. I hope that they improve the turn-based combat quite a bit in
For
that
sure.
one. I have to finish Yakuza 0 someday.
That's you really do. You really, really do. That is one of the best games of the PS4 generation. Absolutely.
Abby says, dolphin riding sequence in FF7, often forgotten.
No. I didn't forget. I just see the hatred for that sequence where you got it. Cloud has to be thrown into the air. And he has to land on some skinny ass wire you can't even see. I hate that so much. I will say what I played of Rebirth, there was a dolphin. I will not say any more than dolphin.
And now we are reaching the tavern. We're settling in. We're hanging out to chat. Continuing the horror tip, I'm watching anime again. I'm watching a new anime.
I'm watching
an anime that was made post-2005 and is not named Gundam.
Whoa. I love this for you.
Congratulations. What is it?
It's called Heavenly Delusion.
Mm.
It is, I believe, 13 episodes. I've finished about 8 of them. And how would I describe it? Last of Us, but it's an anime.
Oh,
it's
boy.
By Production IG. It is visually gorgeous, amazing music. Instead of fungus zombies, you have these things called man-eaters, which I would describe as sort of mini angels. They can't really be killed by conventional means, but there's a boy and a girl traveling through the wasteland. Well, maybe a girl, question mark. Who even knows what's going on there? And the boy can do... the boy can kill the angels or the man-eaters, but nobody else can. So their services are often used to kill them. And just visually, this show looks amazing. It's depictions of the wasteland, really compelling. And then there's this whole other story where there's some kind of strange institute where some sort of experiments are happening, but you're not really sure what's going on. So I think it's one of the hot animes of the year, and it was recommended to me by DJ Bagelpub. So if you want to go check it out, you want a new anime in your life, it's streaming on Crunchyroll right now. No, Hulu. It's on Hulu. Go check it out.
Oh, so I can't watch it because we don't get Hulu in Canada.
Sorry.
It's so stupid. I hate this era of digital crap.
I mean, remember it's not cable? Like we were any better in 1999 or whatever. I mean, when you literally could not get stuff.
Right.
Like, at least you can VPN now.
That's true. But it's a pain in the ass.
It is a pain in the ass. We should be catered to all the time.
We absolutely should. I should be able to. I can't. It shouldn't be that I'm watching a series and I disappear the next day. It's like, oh, okay. Well, what happened there? Well, the rights are up.
That really does irk me when I'm watching a series and it starts going like, you have 3 days left to finish this. And I'm like, what? No, stop. Bad.
Stop. That happened as soon as we started Korra. Korra left Canadian Netflix. It was so ridiculous.
I'm sorry. Eric, have you been watching Heavenly Delusion?
No, it's on my list of stuff I want to watch. It does look really, really interesting. And your recommendation and DJ Bagel Pup's recommendation are definitely selling me more on it. I've mostly been watching Frieren, which I think I've talked about on here, is really, 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 really good. And Jujutsu Kaisen. And I started a few Apothecary's Diary. You might actually like.
That sounds interesting.
It follows an apothecary that gets... kidnapped and sent to work in like the back palace of a like 15th 16th century dynasty where basically it's the rear palace where all the concubines and their servants and eunuchs live, and there is a poisoning that happens, and the apothecary girl is trying to just lay low because she can eventually make enough money to kind of like get her way out of there, but then accidentally reveals that she knows what is going on with the poisoning because she has seen that sort of thing before, and kind of gets caught up in the court politics and all the different scheming and stuff like that. It's very much about court politics, scheming, period piece drama. But it is a really cool concept and setting, and it's really gorgeously animated. And Mango Olds is posting Satoru Gojo in the chat. Yeah, no, JJK has been very, very good this season. And definitely if you want that horror, it's got that horror in there.
I wouldn't call Heavenly Delusion horror per se, but it definitely has horrific elements.
Yeah.
The man-eaters in particular are very scary. And there's several sequences that I would describe as extremely terrifying. I have a lot of like terror around, you know, losing limbs and that kind of thing. And there's one particular sequence where you see a man eater that has, how would I describe, a guillotine for a mouth. And it's just coming at the character and it just bites off a leg. And you're just like, oh, I can't deal with this. Seriously. So... it is a little gory, not overwhelmingly gory, but you will be disturbed, put it that way. So, so go check out Heavenly Delusion. Nani, you're playing Slay the Princess?
No, I am not.
Okay.
Well, someone got their notes mixed up.
Wrong co-host. LOL.
Eric, you're playing Slay the Princess.
Yeah, I have played Slay
Nani
the Princess.
Nani is playing TK because she doesn't fill in the notes.
Because they're stuck on edit for some reason. I can't edit them directly.
On suggesting.
They're stuck on suggesting.
Some Google Docs back end for podcast listeners. I'm playing Slay the Princess. I've played Slay the Princess. I finished Slay the Princess, which is by Black Tabby Games. It is a visual novel in which you wake in the woods and narrator tells you that you need to go slay the princess to save the world. What you do with that information from there on out is completely up to you. And it is essentially a game built around choice. What do you choose to do when things are set out in front of you, and how does the world react to it? And I'm being very coy because this game is definitely about the ways in which it bends and manipulates your choices, because there are recursive loops, let's say. There are loops that happen. And what if the game remembered things, certain things, and the way it plays off of how you interact with it and the choices you make, and even like very, very minute choices you make, is really, really compelling and interesting. I found it to be just a really cool expression of like first impressions of trust, how trust is built between people, of how you interact with a person and how they interact with you, and kind of how you posture. If you walk in very defensively, she might also have her guard up. If you walk down with the blade, so there's a blade you can pick up. And if you walk into the room with a blade, the princess is obviously going to be on guard. So even if you then decide that you want to free the princess and not slay the princess, maybe she's not going to trust you because of that. Maybe she's going to try to murder you because of that. And it's all told with this incredible hand-drawn look. It's got just a really good look to it, and the art is gorgeous, and it really starts delving into cosmic horror, body horror, existential horror, just really any brand of horror you can think of. It goes there, and it gets very, very creepy very fast. I do have some qualms with it. I think there's just some technical stuff. It's largely built on its voice work, and there are moments where I think there were multiple recording sessions, or maybe recording sessions that happened in different places, because there are noticeable mic quality changes between some of the lines.
Yeah, and that could happen.
To put it bluntly, and also it is broadly built on the voice work of two actors, and I think they both do an incredible job. I think there's also some times where there's supposed to be different intonations that they're putting on for their characters that don't always come across super clearly. And the writing can get a little bit flowery, a little bit like broad when I need it to be a little bit more fine. And there's some technical stuff, but it's also like it is earnest. It is so eager to do the thing it wants to do that I think if you like the concept, you are going to find a lot to love here. And especially if you want something, you finish in like 4 hours. It was like a 4-hour run for me to see an end credits. And I will tell you right now here on this podcast, there is no true route, no golden ending. This is a game that is purely about you and how you interact with it. And there are a ton of endings, ton of different things that you could see in the end. But there is not really an idea of trying to seek the true route like there is with visual novels. It is very much about like, how do you want to interact with this thing, and it will respond to you. And I find that very, very compelling.
The way,
yeah, it's great.
The way you're describing it, I don't know, for some reason, running out of Undertale, we kind of glossed over some of its scarier parts. Like, I like games that kind of screw with themselves to give me a scare. Like in Undertale, the way it crashes. Like,
oh yeah, or like a Doki Doki. Yeah,
yeah. But I guess, you know, in the spirit of horror and dead things, I'll go ahead and say I'm still playing Baldur's Gate 3. Obviously, Lizelle is dead. I found her body.
That's she's wild. Just lying. Where'd you find her body?
At the mountain pass. Like,
she's dead.
If you do not recruit her before the grove, and then if you do not help her at the mountain pass where you can meet her later, she does get killed. I mean, yeah. A lot of your companions, this can happen too.
Someone was crying out for help when I started that encounter, but there was a lot of fog of war and confusion. So it's like, oh God, it's a Gith, kill it. Oh shit. Oh,
that's too bad, because Lazelle is a great, great character. Definitely one of my faves in the game.
Bazel.
Yeah. I mean, it gives me motivation to do another run at some point. So
yeah,
there is
co-op
that,
run with us.
Yeah, exactly. But
Just out of curiosity, who would everybody's class be if we were to do a co-op run?
I'm not sure. Right now I'm playing like a rogue assassin druid, which is a weird combination, but I like it a lot.
So I played as a warlock previously, so I'd probably change things up a little bit and go with something slightly different. I used a lot of fighters. I might go with the druid, honestly, because I was really enjoying my time being able to turn into an owlbear and whatnot.
I might go with pure druid. I might go with ranger, but assassin's really good.
Ranger is a great subclass for
I turned Astarion into a ranger mm-hmm. rogue, and he just absolutely murders everything from the distance.
Yeah, I turned Astarion into a rogue ranger assassin, and being able to get on initiative, being able to just go in and murder somebody is really useful in an encounter.
I have also, my rogue has these really cool ass daggers. Like, I got like the King Under the Mountain dagger or whatever it's called, and that's a real beaut. And I'm double wielding.
Are you gonna play as a lizard person, a dragonborn?
I'm playing as a dragonborn right now, but I'm thinking I'd probably do another race for the next time. But I don't know. I like dragonborns a lot. I think they're neat.
I think I might be a drow. I was a tiefling this time around, and I liked being a tiefling, but I think I'd like to be a drow.
I like tiefling. I love playing this game and seeing like, you know, haha, FF14 ripped off this and that. And it's like, I'm kind of mad because their equivalent of a drow has not been touched lore-wise.
I think I would probably go for like a frontline battle mage, because I was looking at build ideas, and there's something funny to me about a really beefy heavy armor dude who just casts spells, stands in the front shooting spells.
One of my first screw around class experiments was Dragon Quest III, where you have a chance. It's very simple to change classes. So I became a soldier that could use magic, and it's like, oh well, this actually is a great class.
I think I would want to be like an orc. An orc that thinks he is a wizard, but is actually just like maybe a barbarian who's using the wild magic or whatever. Because that's one of the barbarian subclasses, right? Is like there's a wild magic subclass for barbarians. So maybe you lean into that and you're like, you're an orc who thinks he does magic. Like, that'd be really fun.
Did you meet the character Lump in the Goblin Camp, who is like the ogre who speaks very eloquently?
I don't think I did.
He's trying to tell, like, you can fool him into thinking you're one of the absolutes, like, you know, cronies. Oh,
yeah. Okay. No, exactly just, like, what you're talking about.
His side orcs are like looking at you like, food, not food, friend. Just the way he talks, I adore it. But I had to kill him. I used to love him, but I had to kill him.
But more importantly, who would be the dark urge in our party?
We all have to flip a coin at the beginning, because one of us has to be the Dark Urge, but we also can't know who it is. I think that's critical. Urge. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Can you explain the Dark Urge to me? Because I haven't really touched that part of the game.
I'm going to be very vague and just say it is a way of playing that game where you play a custom character, but you have a story. You have the way that if you had played as Shadowheart or Will or Lazelle or whatever, that they kind of have their own backstories and their own things going on. The Dark Urge also has that. Whereas when you play as a custom Tav, you kind of don't really have that. You just kind of have everybody else's stuff, but this gives you stuff too. And I don't ascribe to the idea that it's, some people call it like Tav Plus or whatever, like it's the better version of a custom character. I don't ascribe to that, but I do think it's a really interesting way of handling that style of character. So I'm still in Act One with my Dark Urge playthrough, because I haven't been able to get back to BG3 much, but it is a very different and very compelling way to play that game.
I'm going to try that when I have a chance.
That it would be fun. So Mangua Ult said co-op all bards.
Oops, all bards.
Bard is a class that I have not touched basically at all. I've had paladins and rogues and fighters and wizards and all of the usual classes, but I did not have a bard. And I think it would be fun to have a bard in the
party. I turned my subclass for what's his face, the wizard Jabroni. I turned him into a bard because he just seemed like a bard.
Jabroni, you mean Gale?
Gale, that's him, yeah.
Y'all freak me out with the way you change. Someone else told me this. They're like, oh, I made Astarion a wizard. And I was like, Astarion's not a wizard? Like, it's weird to me because these characters are so linked to their classes. Like, Shadowheart is a cleric. Like,
Shadowheart is an evil cleric.
Lazelle is a warrior. Like, Karlach is a barbarian. Like, it is so linked to their personalities that changing their classes weirds me out.
I only changed some of their classes.
It's like naming your Pokemon.
Hey, we will not have any slander about Nimi Pokemon in this chat chat today. But
I'm going to name my Infernape Char, and you're going to like it.
My Infernape named Char.
Yeah.
My character in Baldur's Gate 3 is named Electral Argent Tooth. So there you go.
It's just better than not naming, just going with Shizor. Why have Shizor when you can name them the Red Comet? But I think I've messed around with every single class in Baldur's Gate 3 except Bard. So I think, and having a Bard in the party would mean having a killer, absolutely killer face character during social encounters.
Mm. Oh, he's perfect. Yeah.
And if the Bard is the Dark Urge, Dark Urge Bard is
the Dark Urge Bard plays metal.
Freaking serial killer Bard.
I hate life. Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, this is
Ozzy Oz.
No. I hate you.
And the monster just like dies of sadness because it's been told off so badly.
I just keep imagining Ozzy Osbourne as like an RPG character.
That would rock. That would be amazing. I want to play that game right now. His power is he bites the head off a bat and sprays everyone with the blood and has rabies.
Sharon, we've got to go save them from the Moonrise Tower.
What? Oh, bugger these myconoids.
All right. Is there anything else we want to cover before we move on?
I'll try to keep Lazel alive next time.
Please
I
do.
I played a little bit Alan Wake 2. I'm not that far in enough to like speak big on it, but like it's good. It's definitely more Alan Wake. It's real cool. So they made Resident Evil 2 remake, but Alan Wake. And if that is cool to you, then it's very good.
I might give it a try sometime.
I want to tease an indie RPG that I've been playing that I can't really speak about yet, but please look forward to next week when we talk about it. I'm really enjoying it. Amazing art style. You might be able to figure out what I'm saying by that. But okay, that's it for the tavern. Nadia, take us home.
Lust auf besonders feine Weihnachten? Erlebe einzigartigen Genuss mit Rewe Feine Welt. Diese Woche zum Beispiel Rewe Feine Welt Cheesecake Spekulatius, je 85 Gramm Glaspackung, nur 1,49 Euro. Oder Rewe Feine Welt Bio Glühwein, je 0,7 Liter Flasche, nur 3,49 Euro. Festlich sparen mit Genuss. Rewe, dein Markt.
We were talking about Halloween stuff, so I can't resist because it's, of course, the last episode before Halloween. And I got to know. Oh, thank you, whoever left before my story. That fills me with confidence. What is the craziest shit you found in your Halloween bag? I'll go first. Now, growing up, I kind of grew up in a community that had had a lot of kids. It was a place where people were supposed to raise their children in affordable houses that now cost over $1 million. But we all kind of like hung around in a pack and went house to house. And sometimes a parent would come with us, like usually my mom would come with us. And some of the weird shit I've gotten in my bags. Number one, a toothbrush. Who does that?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is it? Freaking dentist. Anyone who hands out a toothbrush is going to jail. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Number two, I got a pack of Old Maid cards. And that was kind of fun, actually, because my friends and I, like, that was the last time I went trick-or-treating that I remember. We just kind of sat and played Old Maid and ate candy. It's like, oh, you know what? This isn't a bad way to spend Halloween because we're old and we don't know how to have fun anymore. And third thing I got that was really interesting was this mysterious-looking candy that had a lobster on the wrapper and had, like, acrylic writing or Polish or something like that. And I'm like, what in God's name is this? And I ate it. It's like, oh, that's actually pretty good. It's like a nice nougaty kind of candy.
So
and
it wasn't the portal into the dark dimension, but it's also a pretty good nougaty candy.
It was. But it wasn't until the internet was invented that I realized, oh, okay, that's actually, I don't remember if it was Russian or Polish, but it was a specific brand of candy that had a lobster on it. It was called Little Lobsters. And I'm like, oh, well, that's good because when I ate it, I thought it would taste like lobster. And I was terrified that would happen. But I was like, no, that's actually pretty good. So, yeah, what about you, like, Eric, did you find like Chick Tracks because you lived in like Texas?
I was gonna say, I don't think I ever got one of those, but I do feel like I remembered seeing them I have seen those in person, but I don't know if it was when I was trick-or-treating as a young child, or if they were like being dumped on college campuses or whatever, like you see them somewhere, but
yeah, they get around.
Yeah, I don't think I ever got one of those. Toothbrush for sure. This is a candy, but I think it's a horrible candy. A circus peanut.
Circus peanuts are nasty.
I'm not a circus peanut fan. And also maybe a deeply unsettling one is getting like a Christmas candy. Yeah. So getting like a candy
That's
cane.
That's just wrong. Getting a candy cane in your Halloween.
It's unsettling.
Flying a kite at night.
Exactly. It's unsettling because you don't know if they bought their Christmas candy early.
Yeah.
Or if they are offloading late Christmas candy.
There is an awful, awful candy in Canada, and I don't think it's reached the border yet, thank your God. It's called Molasses Kisses, and it tastes like shit, but they're really popular with old people. And I always hated them, but they keep like surviving generation after generation. Who was eating them? If you were eating Molasses Kisses and you live in Canada, please stop. Please stop the horror. It has to end.
I think I got pretty conventional candy in my my thing. I always liked the more caramelly chocolates.
Those hurt my teeth.
Or that kind of thing. Almond Joys, gross. But
Almond Joys are nasty.
Milk Duds are all right. I'm partial to the Milk Duds. Maybe we should do a tier maker of Halloween candy.
Not that Milk Duds are like infamous for taking teeth out in my family.
Period.
Yeah, when all the kids were losing their teeth, we would eat stuff like Mike and Ike's or Milk Duds, and they're so chewy and so sticky that they would just yank a tooth out with them.
I would eat, we have in Canada, Macintosh toffee, and that would take care of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, that was good,
though. Big fear of losing a filling to...
Me too.
To a Milk Dud.
To that. Somebody ranked ten best Halloween candies. Do you want to hear them really quickly?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Sure, sure.
Number 10, Tootsie Rolls.
Oh, classic.
Yeah,
you can't go wrong with Tootsie Rolls.
Never mad about a Tootsie Roll.
Number 9, Sour Gummy Worms.
Like the bag of sour gummy worms?
Who's handing out? I'm not eating a loose gummy
worm. I don't think I ever
worm.
Got anything that big. I can say that I prefer gummies to chocolates for the most part.
That's fair. I could see that.
I am a gelatin fan. Number 8, Skittles. Moves, never a big Skittles fan.
Oh, I'm
never a big
Skittles
fan, no. When I worked as a custodian at Canada's Wonderland, we had a vending machine. The only thing it could dispense properly was Skittles. So I would just kind of eat them and hate it.
It could only dispense Skittles. And that vending machine is now banned in California.
Are Skittles banned in California?
Yeah, yeah. It's because something that they put in the...
The sperm killing red dye or whatever.
Wait, what?
Yeah,
should
Skittles
I not be eating Skittles?
Probably not.
Should I stop eating Skittles?
It's a very California move. Number 7, caramel apple lollipops. Really enjoy them. Hard to get open and eat though.
Oh, lollipop. Okay, I thought just like caramel apples. I was like, who is handing this out?
Can you imagine putting that in a bag and you take it out and it's like just got candies stuck to it?
I did see someone post an image of like a trick or treat bowl filled with just uncooked hot dogs, and I was like, "That's so funny."
I saw one full of pierogies. Sounds great.
The next one is an S tier Halloween candy for me. Tootsie Pops.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good old Tootsie Pops.
Three.
I love Tootsie Pops.
I love a good Tootsie Pop. Number 5, a Starburst. Yeah, they're fine.
If they're not yellow, I don't like yellow.
Really? I like pink. I like the pink Starburst.
Pink is the best one.
I like the cherry ones.
Really? Cherry.
Like the light red one? You can have all of mine.
Yeah, no,
the cherry ones
like just explode with flavor. Like they're the ones that have the most like flavor in them.
Number 4, Snickers. Nah. Number 3, Mounds.
Oh, no, I love a Snickers. It's a good time.
Yeah, they're fine. Number 3,
that's like
my go-to. How dare you? What's going on?
Mounds
coconut?
It's the coconut one. Ew.
Number 2, Kit Kats.
Yeah, okay.
Only if they're Japanese Kit Kats. And number 1, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. They're fine. But this list is missing Twix.
If you are ever in Canada, please get Kit Kats over here. Something is wrong with American Kit Kats. I don't know what it is. It tastes like plastic.
The number one for me, this might be weird, is a Baby Ruth. I love a good Baby Ruth. That is like a top tier candy bar for me. And a Payday. Like those. I think I just
I love Payday. Payday's number one for
Payday's
me.
Payday's hit.
You cannot get Paydays in Canada unless they're like some weird like dollar store thing where someone bought an overstock and it tastes like an old shoe. But I love Paydays. So good.
And the thing is, like, I tested this recently because when I was in New York, we were in a bodega getting some stuff and I saw they had Payday, like full bar Paydays. I never see that down here. They don't sell bars of Payday in gas stations out here. And I'd been thinking about Paydays. So I was like, yo, let me get that Payday bar. And I don't think I want a full bar of Payday. I want that little fun size bar of Payday. That's the right amount of Payday. I think big bars of Payday do not hit the same. But
just enough. Yeah, when I have a bar of Payday, I always kind of break it in half because you can't eat it all at once. So you kind of get sick.
Oh, it's so much. It's so much.
But yeah, to answer a question in the chat, Kit Kat is handled by Hershey in America and by Nestle everywhere else. Like here, you can get green tea Kit Kats here very easily. Just go to the grocery store. We have a whole bunch of flavors. But America's kind of weird with this Kit Kat. It's a
shout
totally
out
different
to Experience
animal.
Share, which carries flavored Kit Kats. Much love.
There you go.
And that's it for this week's episode of Axe to the Blood God. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on the podcatcher of your choice. And you can subscribe to us on Patreon, where for just $1 a month, you get access to our Discord, and you can support the pod, and you get it ad-free. Thank you, as always, to our Stars of Destiny for joining us. And this week, we're joined by Abby of the Moon, Anthrax Bees, Cave Full of Zubats, Drew RWX, Flashback 2012, Harvest Lunatech, Cal L, Mango Alts, and Ruka. Thank you so much for joining us, as always, on Axe of the Blood God. We're heading now into the post show with the rest of the Stars in Destiny, where I'm sure we'll talk more about Halloween candy and everything else. But for everybody else, we'll be back next week, and until then, happy adventuring.
Should boost morale.
Mama, gibst du mir dein Rezept fürs Hühnerfrikassee? Die Kinder lieben das.
Klar, ist doch ganz einfach. Gehst in den Supermarkt, kaufst Froster Hühnerfrikassee und haust das schön in die Pfanne. Genauso lecker wie von mir. Aber sag's keinem.
Doch, mach ich.
Hä?
Peter von Froster hier. Unser Hühnerfrikassee schmeckt wie von Oma selbst gekocht. Mit natürlichen Zutaten nach dem Froster Reinheitsgebot. Gibt's im Supermarkt.
Sag ich doch.
Froster ist für alle da.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons. Oder, Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser